Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, a program that is devoted to the most important and the largest segment of our society. To those of you who know that all of the world's religious, political, economic, academic, military, and yes, even media institutions are corrupt, that all of these have become counterproductive and that none of them can be fixed. Our phone number, if you would like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 2 hours, is 877-300-7645. We have been able to have a slight change of program here these last few days. We've had Kirk call in regarding what is written leading up to the oft-cited verse for Christianity. If there was a statement verse for the religion, I don't want to think anymore, this is all I'm going to cite, it would be John 3:16. It's the passage you see in front of so many sporting events. You know, somebody holds up a sign and says J 3:16. And what they want you to do is turn to this and read it and read nothing else. Don't think about what came before it. Don't think about what was said after it. Don't bother to recognize that most of the Christian New Testament is in complete and irreconcilable conflict with everything that precedes it in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And so what we have done is taken a bit of a departure from the news, and the reason that this particular departure, I think, is worthwhile, and why I think it's reasonable for us to diminish our or to at least veer away temporarily from our normal first hour news format, is that this concept of citing one statement wholly out of context, mistranslated, misunderstood, to justify not bothering to study, not bothering to read, not bothering to examine the evidence available to us, not bothering to think, to be discerning, to exercise good judgment, simply to believe one errantly translated statement, misrepresented, out of context. Now, I don't know how many people have been precluded from thinking based upon the knee-jerk of John 3:16. It is the fulcrum upon which the Billy Graham Crusades, for example, and of an evangelical Christianity hinge. Now, I realize that most Christians are Christians because they were born into the religion. They haven't even bothered to need. I mean, there is no need for them to even have a justification like John 3:16. They're just simply Christians because they were born that way. I understand we have Kirk. Thank you for joining me again early this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I don't know what percentage of Christians are cut off at the knees, are truncated in their development and their thinking based upon this passage. But I would suspect that in nations like America and throughout Europe, the places that speak English, New Zealand and Australia, places such as this, Canada, that the number is fairly high, that it would be maybe a third of Christians will forego thinking by simply passing this statement, John 3:16, through their brains, that maybe two-thirds of Christians are simply Christians because they were born into it and they've been indoctrinated and never bothered to think. They've had no reason to think.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to that that perspective?
Well, I think that's true down south. They don't ask you, do you go to church? They ask you, what church do you go to? You know, it's just
yes.
You are, and you have a very large Protestant population, a lot of Baptists, a lot of Presbyterians and so forth, and it's just a way of life.
Yeah. You know, it's even a way of life on the left and right coast. At least it is not so much a way of life, I guess, as an assumption. For example, I'll have a number of things where somebody will want to work on the weekend. I said, "Dear, why don't we do it on Sunday?" And they says, "Oh no, you know, I'd rather do it on Saturday." And I said, "Well, I'd really rather you not do it on Saturday. I'd rather you do it on Sunday." And or they'll have a happy Easter or Merry Christmas or that sort of thing. And if I actually know the person, and there's something, there's any chance of a positive response, I say, I'm not a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not a Christian. And when you say you're not a Christian, in today's society, even in places where the prevalence of Christianity has waned considerably, would you say, I'm not a Christian? Just that blunt.
Mm-hmm.
People look at you like, "What are you, a heathen? Are you an occultist? Are you a pagan? Are you a flaming, you know, atheist? You don't look, you know, I'm Native American, I'm Sioux Indian. You don't look Jewish to me. Are you Jewish?"
Yeah, they do that. Talk about the Sabbath, then immediately you're Jewish.
Oh boy, then if you say, "No, I'm Torah observant." Oh, so you're Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
No. No, I'm not Jewish. I'd be delighted if I was, but I'm not. And to observe the Torah is not to be Jewish, nor is it to be religious. In fact, it's the antithesis of being religious, is to observe the Torah. Just happens to be the testimony, inspired testimony, of the one and only God. Mm-hmm. I thought it might be in my interest to observe it. Pay attention to what it had to say, but you know,
yeah,
it's just
Johnny,
people.
You know what the word "observe" means?
Yeah, I know what the word "observe" means. You know, I can use my eyes to read. I can use my nephesh soul to be aware of what is around me. In particular, in the case of observing the Torah, the only way you can observe the Torah is to read it. Fully vested in this concept of animals are different than plants, because animals have souls.
Mm-hmm.
And a soul enables you to observe your environment, to take in what is happening around you and respond to it. That is the difference between having a soul, which all animals have, and being a plant.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess being a rock and not having any life. But I'm fully vested in this concept of being observant. I'm typically observant before I walk across the street. How about you?
Well, yeah, but let's take it one step further. You also know the difference between a nephesh soul and a nesama.
Yes, I do.
And you know,
and the you know, and there is a huge leap there, isn't there?
Yes, sir.
It's only humans that have a nesama. Well, I have to be really careful there. You know what distinguishes humanity by saying that he made us like him by providing us with a nesama? He did not say that he did not give a nesama to some animals. If he did, he did not think it was germane to mention it to us. I mean, small things, but you know, you sometimes you see in a dog, for example, that's part of the family, remorse for doing something that you know is inappropriate, or sadness, or happiness, pleasure, you know, and there's some responses that say, you know, that's exercising judgment. And so, you know, I want to be careful to say that other animals don't have one. We just don't know of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this nesoma, Kirk, is an essential part of making being observant, of working to augment the capacity of your soul, which is to observe and to respond.
Yeah,
and how does it do that? What does this nesoma add that we wouldn't simply have if all we had was an animal soul?
Well, you couldn't make a distinction between a choice between good and evil, or this choice is safe and this choice is not safe. You know, how would you do that if you didn't have the ability? What good would it be to observe something if you can't make a decision about it?
Right. Yeah, the Nisalma is gives us the capacity to exercise good judgment, to be discerning, to be moral, to be just, to be civil. It is that part of us where we can be discriminating and examine what we have observed and determine what connections we might be able to make between those things, identify patterns, and then make choices. So the Nisalma empowers that. And it's interesting, of course, that Yahweh says that the Nisalma is what made Adam like him, in his image. And so that means that Yahweh, God, that's God's one and only name, has a Nisalma. He has the ability to exercise good judgment, so that he can't be the capricious, whatever you want him to be, God of Christianity. He isn't a God that says, I'm going to love all the little children, because that would not be discriminating. So when you apply the fact that the Nisalma was distinctly, according to the Torah, what made man uniquely like God, like our creator cannot be universally accepting.
No.
If you're universally accepting, you're not exercising your Nisalma. Yeah. And it also means that this ability to process information, to think, to exercise good judgment, to take in what we observe and to make connections so that we understand, all of which are empowered by the Nisalma, is the very thing that makes us like God.
Mm-hmm.
That's powerful insight all by itself.
Sure.
So when people of faith are precluded from thinking because of a statement out of context, it's a big deal. It's important that we address it. And that was the case of a man with whom your wife was trying to share the truth. When we return, we're going to reestablish the criterion, the situation that led to this evaluation, retrace our progress thus far, and then move into more new material.
Welcome back to Gathering Mercy.
This we have Kirk on the line. Kirk, could you kind of reset the scenario that led us to examining what came before in the context of the famed truncated citation, John 3:16?
Well, we had a friend, a neighbor, and he was very interested after we mentioned a few things. That was early, I don't know. We had probably both read Yada Yah for about a year or so or more, or maybe two, maybe a year and a half. But we would share it rather liberally with anyone who wanted to listen, probably with people who didn't want to listen, but we didn't know that. But we were sharing our insights that we drew from all that research, and one was a Christian, and he got it. I mean, he appeared to get it. He understood it. He thought that was wonderful. It was like, wow, I didn't realize that. And then they move along and progress, and then you have more and more conversations. They might listen to the program as well, or download the book and read it to them. And as it turned out, when it really came, the push came to shove, his when he ran across, you must be circumcised, one of the five things of the covenant that you, agreement that you have to make, you have to deal with in order to become part of Yahweh's family. When he came to that point, he was not circumcised, therefore he didn't want to participate. That was too much for him. And it came down to, in his explanation, our last conversation along those lines were, you know, I'll just cling to John 3:16.
Yeah. Of course, the issues with just clinging to John 3:16 and ignoring Yahweh's statement that you have to be circumcised as a male to participate in the covenant, which means to have a relationship with Yahweh, to engage in Passover, to answer the invitation to attend Passover, which is the only means to eternal life. as part of God's family. And number three, to enter heaven, which is the only way to be part of God's home, is to be circumcised as a man. And it's actually parents that, as the requirement of the covenant, are asked to circumcise their sons so that everyone remembers the importance of the covenant that Yahweh has established with us. The weirdest part of negating all of Yahweh's testimony for a simply believe in Jesus Christ is that the Christian has no idea who he is.
No.
I mean, what are they believing in? Because the Christian Jesus Christ bears no resemblance to Yahweh, and he is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. In fact, they disassociate him from Yahweh's character and Yahweh's testimony because they don't like Yahweh's character and they don't like Yahweh's testimony. So they completely disassociate the diminished manifestation of Yahweh from Yahweh and from his testimony, which means that all you really have left is a caricature, and that caricature is loosely based on Dionysus. So your belief is misplaced. It's like saying that, you know, if I believe in Abraham Lincoln, then I'm a good patriot. And yet the characterization of Abraham Lincoln today bears almost no resemblance to the actual man. I mean, the actual man was a repulsive racist. I mean, he was the racist of the highest order. He wanted to actually quarantine blacks. The reason he didn't want more slave states is that he wanted blacks put on a reservation, and said, you know, that blacks could never be part of normal society and could never integrate in, with whites, and they just needed to be isolated from the rest of humanity. And that's what he said during the presidential debate. So if you were to have put your faith in Abraham Lincoln, the icon, the caricature, bears no resemblance to the actual individual. This is even more exaggerated with the Christian Jesus Christ.
And that's totally found in any history book if you want to look for it. And same, they did the same thing to the Indian. I mean, they're not worthy to be human beings. They have to go live on a reservation.
Yeah, they were called savages. And yet, by comparison to the savages from Europe that robbed them of their land, of their property, and of their lives, the savages were the Europeans, not the native peoples. All examples of a revisionist history that has created a misimpression of, for example, this misimpression of America being a great and peaceful nation. Our history is as bad as any history of any nation on the planet. I mean, but yet we recast ourselves in sound bites and propaganda to make it appear quite differently. That being the case, we're going to begin with John 2, 18 through 22, and then read up through where we are to consider precisely what it means to trust and rely upon the Son. We'll be back. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. One of the most interesting conversations in our brief history took place in Jerusalem. It took place just shy of 2,000 years ago. One party was a Pharisee. They would be the right-wing religious wackos today. It would be, Pharisaic Judaism is probably somewhat akin to the black hats, the ultra-Orthodox, you know, that run around Israel today with their little curly cue in their hair and their black hats, their black suits,
and New York.
And in New York, and they spend all day being religious. I mean, their every thought is to be religious. They got to look religious, they got to act religious, and they're constantly reciting rabbinic prayers from the Talmud. So one of these two parties, Nicodemus, was a Pharisee. A rabbi named Nicodemus. Now, my guess is that we have an error here. It just shows part of malfeasance that's associated with retention of the Christian New Testament, very poorly maintained.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Ademus, what is the happening? I'm going to ask you this question. There is no reason for you to know the answer, but do you know what the name Nicodemus is based on?
No, I hadn't looked it up. So.
Oh. Yep. The name Nicodemus is not a Hebrew name. It's a Greek name.
Like Nike?
Yeah, absolutely. You got it, Nike. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, in Yohanan, the revelation to Yohanan, when Yosha is speaking to the Ephesians, he says that he is pleased that they have not accepted the dogma of the Nicolaitans. And that it's a primary reference to the birth of Roman Catholicism, which took place in the Council of Nicaea in the same the Greek city named after the Greek god Nike of victory. So there is no chance that a traditional ultra-religious Pharisee is going to have a name that bears the name of a Greek god. You know, in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, in fact, in the Torah itself, doesn't Yahweh say that the names of false and foreign gods should not be on your lips?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's no chance the man's name is Nicodemus. So you have to, and this is a real advantage, by the way, when you recognize that there is an error here, because, you know, Christians will hold up their New Testament as if it were the inerrant word of God, when in fact there are more differences between the manuscripts that comprise the Christian New Testament and the 70 earliest manuscripts, those that have been unearthed from the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century, than there are words. In fact, there are 300,000 known discrepancies, only 182,000 words. So it's,
you know, even in this sentence, I've got two other translations where he just goes, Nicodemus is a leading man among the Jews, and then there's he's a member of the Jewish council. Doesn't say anything about a rabbi
there. Yeah. Yeah. No, it doesn't. It doesn't call him. He uses the term rabbi. But
yeah,
the very fact is that he was a Pharisee from this text. And you know, they call him a ruler. As a Pharisee, he would not have been a ruler. He would have been part of the Pharisaic council, which means he could have been part of the Sanhedrin. But he was a Pharisee, and he was a fairly high-ranking Pharisee, based upon the Greek text here. But the Greek text gives us a name that cannot be his name.
Mm.
By way of background, according to Yohanan, Yahusha was in town for Pesach. Now that's something to think about. You wonder why Christians don't say, you know, I'm going to rely on that. Yahusha celebrated Passover, so by golly, I'm going to celebrate
Passover.
So this idea they're going to believe in a fella, their Jesus Christ, who observed Passover, but they're going to ignore that. How are you going to believe him?
Well,
if you don't know what he did, if you don't do the same things that he did, it doesn't have any influence over you. And he would ultimately, of course, be the sacrificial lamb. Yeah, he had just cleared the temple, which is Yahweh's home here in Jerusalem, of the merchants and money changers. And it was a indication that you ought not profit by pretending to play a role in the in people's quest to form a relationship with Yahweh. Yahweh's principal home here on earth was the temple on the Temple Mount. And while he was here in his diminished human manifestation, his temple, his home here on earth, was the physical body that the spirit occupied of Yosha. And what he's saying here is, when we're going to, you know, go into this context here, is that, you know, you really, when you capitalize monetarily on pretending that you're an intermediary to God or providing access to God, you really, really upset God. And so if you're the Roman Catholic Church and you're making billions, changing people's money for promises that are unfounded, ooh, making God really mad. If you're a pastor and you're paid a salary to be a church pastor, you're provided a home as a church pastor. If you're done any of those things, then you're Pauline, because according to Paul, that's just fine. But according to God, it's not. He would overturn your table.
Yeah.
The priests and who were served as ministers to help people participate in the invitations to meet with God in the Torah, were they paid any money?
No, they specifically are not allowed to own things and get paid.
Right.
You can feed them. I mean, you can do.
Feed them,
that.
Right?
Yeah.
That's clothe them. You can feed them.
Three urchins, but they're not paid. It's not a paid position.
That is correct. Okay, so that's this unreligious act of saying you shall not profit, pretending to serve the interests of those seeking to enter my home, that the religious leaders in Israel, in Jerusalem, confronted Yahusha. This is what it says, and I'm going to read it from John Yohanan 2:18-22.
Sure.
Then the Israelites demanded of him, "What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all of this?" Now, context. What did he do? He just overturned the profitability. He just exposed and condemned the profit motive associated with religion. What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all of this? Now, they didn't bother to say, you know, okay, you got us there. You know, the Torah is really clear that we are not to profit financially based on anything associated with God's home. Yeah, okay. All right. Your authority would be the Torah. You know, if you were open-minded, if you were rational, if you were observant, you'd just say, okay, I get it. That's he got us on that one. Yahusha answered them, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." So when he gave them that answer, do you have to think your way through it to understand what he's talking about?
No, you can pretty well, you know, he's using a metaphor. He's the
right
temple. You know?
Yeah, but let's say that you were in that group that was confronting him, uh-huh, and you didn't bother to associate his act with the Torah, and he gave you that answer. Would you immediately think that he's talking about destroying the temple that he's standing in front of, and that
well,
he himself
the apostles did. I mean, that's what they
did. Yeah, the apostles did. They and so his audience would have. So to understand what he was actually saying, you would really have to make connections and think, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So his answer tells us is the same is Yahweh's style throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. If you're going to simply stop at the superficial, you're going to miss the overwhelming benefit of what he's saying.
Yeah.
This is the way God communicates. You know, we talked about adding the Nesama to the Nefesh, the consciousness, which is the Nefesh, to our conscience, which is our ability to think. This is an example of if you're simply using your soul, your consciousness, you're going to miss this. You've got to kick your ability to think into gear to be able to understand what he's talking about.
Now, when you get a little further, over the weekend I looked up everything about spirit. Every word is used as spirit, and also mm-hmm. from an ancient Hebrew perspective. So when we get to that little part,
okay,
I'll tell you what I discovered. It's pretty
okay.
Right along those lines makes perfect sense.
Okay. So,
let me interrupt. Go ahead.
All right. So what he's saying here now is that the physical building that was behind him and he himself are one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being the case, where is the temple that was standing behind him? Where is it presented and described and explained?
Well, it's on the Temple Mount. I mean, it's described in the Torah.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, the Torah is sitting right there in the center of it.
Right. The Torah sits in the center of it, right next to the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat. The Torah is forever adjacent to it, next to it. You've got a building that every aspect, its size, its accoutrements, its furnishings, everything associated with this building is explained in minute detail in the Torah. Now, wouldn't that mean that to understand its purpose, we'd also have to think our way through it?
To be focused on the Torah.
Yeah. If you just look at a loaf of bread as a loaf of bread and say, that's a loaf of bread, aren't you going to miss the concept of why Yahweh uses grain, purified grain and chaff, and also yeast to describe saved and lost souls? During this very conversation with Kirk, the reason I'm emphasizing here that Yahusha is equating himself to the temple, to Yahweh's presence here on earth, is that the centerpiece of the Torah is the covenant. But the second most important aspect of the Torah is explaining Yahweh's presence with his people. You know, he was present in the tent of the tabernacle, this tent of the enduring and restoring witness. He was present as the brilliant light on the top of the mountain, as a pillar of light during the night, as a glowing cloud of effervescent light during the day. He was present with Abraham, and he was present leading the children out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. Yahweh was present with his people, and his presence was always conveyed through the temple, and the temple was where was called as it traveled with the people throughout the Torah times, and throughout the Torah, the temple was always the restoring and enduring tent or home of the witness, of the testimony. So, if Yahusha is equating himself to that building, what is he equating himself to?
Well, the Torah. He is the
Absolutely. Yeah, he says, I'm the Torah. He says, I'm the witness, I'm the testimony of Yahuwah. Because that's what the purpose of that structure was. He's also saying, I am Yahuwah with you.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what Yahuwah's presence was always there in the tent of the testimony of the tabernacle. So he's saying, I am Yahuwah. That's my answer to your question is, what miraculous sign? I am Yahuwah here among you. I am the Torah in your presence. I am the living word of God right here, right now. That's my authority. And also, the specific authority is that Torah says you should not profit through religion. You shouldn't profit in anything associated with Yahuwah. All right, so when you equate that then, Kirk, to John 3:16, that all you got to do is believe. How can you believe in a God wholly disassociated from Yahuwah, his testimony, his restoring witness, his presence among his people, and think that that's going to work for you when in the preamble to this very discussion, he says, I am the living embodiment of that, of the Torah.
Well, there's no association when you just say, I got to believe in something. There's no, familial relationship there. It's just a concept. It's a Greek kind of idea. You just have a belief. Okay.
Okay. Said another way then, Kirk, if the Christian's response was, I'm not going to pay attention to the instructions that are in the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, I'm going to believe that that if I just put faith in Jesus Christ, I'm going to be saved. How is it that it's possible that this Jesus Christ could have created a new paradigm that where circumcision was now renounced, when in fact he's the living embodiment of the very Torah that is the only place where the Torah, where the covenant and circumcision are explained to us?
Well, then it makes everything he did and everything he said a moot point. I mean, it's not even necessary. Why there?
Why'd he even bother to come? I mean, why was he there for Passover? If, in fact, all of that stuff was negated. Yeah, it's just, mind-blowing, isn't it? So then the Israelites came to him and said, what miraculous sign can you show to prove your authority to do all this? And Yahusha answered them, destroy this temple and I will raise it up in 3 days. The Israelites replied, it took 46 years to build this temple and you're going to raise it in 3 days? But the temple he had spoken of was his body, as was the tabernacle, as it was the tabernacle of Yahweh's spirit. After Yahusha was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said, and they trusted the scripture and the words that Yahusha had spoken. So this concept raised from the dead, which I have probably poorly translated here, this does not say that Yahusha's physical body would be raised from the dead, does it?
No.
No. It says that Yahusha is going to go to the place of the dead and be raised out of it. And this connection, all those connections need to, absolutely need to be made. And we'll return to this concept when we return with Kirk and John 3:16 in a moment.